The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good evening, everybody, and the title of the presentation that I'm to give, I'm working to the title given to me, is the same as what Professor Groves addressed. And I have to tell you that much of what I present directly will contradict what Professor Groves has said. So it's up to you to decide which of us is more likely to be speaking the truth, or maybe we're both wrong. You've heard his presentation of the, and also those of you present at the lunchtime panel would have heard Dr. Leinweber's perspective on long ages, basically as applied to the fossil record. The fossil record is meant to represent the order of evolution and extinction over millions and billions of years. Something that might shock you is I'm quite happy with the fossil evidence. As a young earth creationist, I've got exactly the same evidence and will point to the same evidence that the long-age evolutionists will be pointing to. But we interpret it differently. And you can't tell me that the data speak for themselves. When I was doing my agricultural science degree, so I'm not a high-flying physicist, I'm certainly not a paleontologist, but when I was doing my ag science degree, I had a friend doing his agricultural science degree at the same time. He's an atheist. I'd started my degree as an atheist, but I finished as a Christian. I wasn't a young earth creationist when I finished my PhD. That took another 12 years. But by the way, I've actually got more in common with those of you present tonight who are atheists than those of you who are Christians who think you can accept long ages, because I was 12 years a Christian accepting evolution, accepting long ages, and then 16 years ago I became a young earth creationist, but I was an atheist for 25 years, so the majority of my life I professed atheism. Anyway, my atheist friend doing the PhD and I would come in the morning and we'd open our filing cabinets to see if the data had done any speaking for themselves during the night. Of course, they hadn't. We had to do the hard yards to interpret the data. So the question is to acknowledge that we all have a bias, but what is the best bias with which to be biased? And so tonight we're going to be looking at some of the fossil evidence that's around, and there is a lot of fossil evidence around. But are you going to believe the evolutionary spin that places like the Australian National Dinosaur Museum put on it? Or are you going to believe the paradigm that I will be putting to you tonight? See, according to this display at the Australian National Dinosaur Museum, you've got a creature living and dying, sinking to the bottom, slowly getting covered over and buried, and then is later exposed for today's scientists to find it. They better find it quickly, because these things do tend to decay once they're exposed. So as we go through these next 40 minutes, please be thinking of the evolutionary paradigm for interpreting the fossils versus what I'm putting to you. Because when you look at the fossil evidence, there are many examples of exquisitely preserved creatures. And that exquisite preservation phrase is one you'll see in many secular evolutionary peer-reviewed papers. Exquisite preservation. Here's a dinosaur chick, if that's the right term for a young dinosaur, preserved at the exact moment that it was hatching out of its shell. And here's an interesting fossil that especially primary school boys love it, and I present this to them. This is actually a piece of fossil dinosaur dung. It's one of the largest coprolites ever discovered, 7 kilograms. So today we don't see chicken eggs being preserved at the moment they're hatching out. We don't see lots of dung being fossilised. So how can it be that we find these in the fossil record? Now I've got a little question exercise here for all the Christians present. Hands up if you're willing to acknowledge that you profess Christ publicly. Put your hand up. Quite a few of you. Okay. I've got a question for you, and I'm not necessarily asking if you believe this. I'm just asking about the knowledge of what the Bible says. On which day of creation week, according to the account in Genesis, did God make dinosaurs? I'm going to go through the options, so have a quick look at the options and decide which one you put your hand up for. And if you put your hand up to say you're a Christian, I expect you to put your hand up once to this question. Put your hand up if you're honest enough to admit you don't know. Okay, thank you. What about day six? Okay, day five. Quite a few. Day four. Day three. Day two. We're running out of options. Day one. Well, those of you put your hand up for day six. Yes, according to the Bible, that's when God made dinosaurs. Dinosaurs being land animals. Day six. Okay, another question. This is the last question, by the way. On which day of creation week did God make grass? Put your hands up if you don't know what the Bible says. Thank you for your honesty. Okay, what about day six? Day five? Quite a few. Day four? Day three? Day two? Last option, day one? Nobody. Well, the correct answer is actually day three. And so this raises a problem, because for years the illustrators of children's books about dinosaurs were told by the paleontologists, don't you dare draw dinosaurs walking across grassland, because grassland didn't appear until after the dinosaurs became extinct. And the children's books still show that. But in the published papers, there's now been a complete U-turn because of evidence that gave the long-age evolutionists a time travel problem, because they found evidence not only that dinosaurs had walked on grass, but they ate it. What was the evidence they found? It was fossilised dinosaur dung with the remains of grasses in it, so well preserved that botanists were able to identify what sorts of grasses. Now, you can see that's an article I've written in Creation magazine. It's not the sort of article that I would ever be able to get published in mainstream media. There is something going on that is suppressing the voice of the Christians on this issue. What we do, though, is to try and get the word out to as many who are willing to listen. Just consider the evidence. Because if you believed what the Bible has said, you would never have said that grass disappeared, that grass didn't exist until after the dinosaurs became extinct because of the creation account. Now, if you're looking for that article, that issue of Creation magazine has long since out of print, but after a one-year embargo, in fairness to our subscribers, we put the text of our articles up on the web. So you can find it on our website called creation.com. By the way, those of you who subscribe to Creation magazine are actually helping us to keep going. Alright, so if you'd like to see more of these articles on the web, accessible for free by people right around the world, then subscribe to Creation magazine. Of course, the corollary applies too. If you don't want us to do this work, just don't subscribe to Creation magazine. Now, I would appeal to all the Christians here, please can you be like the Bereans? Acts chapter 17, verse 11. Examine the scriptures when you hear some claims being made to see if it fits with what God has said. In Proverbs, we read there are six things the Lord hates, and one of them, very blunt language here, is a false witness who calls out lies. We are called not to bear false witness. And so we need, in order to be able to spot false witness when it's being relayed to us by children's books, written by evolutionists or whatever, we need to know what God has said about the order of creation. Some of the attack against what's in the Bible is very subtle. I've noticed that the word evolution, they've realised it tends to spook the Christians, so they'll take evolution out of a lot of media articles. In fact, even billions of years, it's become such a nervous line of defence that they'll often take that out too and just speak in terms of before. They've discovered that through the evidence that grass now was around while the dinosaurs were still alive. And they just use the word before or after, and that automatically has connotations of millions of years. So you know, I haven't got time tonight to go through all the arguments about biological evolution, why we didn't come from goo to you via the zoo, but I can just take a few snippets of hostile witnesses, and yes, Professor Groves said that we creationists are guilty of often quoting evolution scientists, and I'm going to do that right now. This is Dr. Stanley in 1991, when he said the fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. Now, of course, we often hear and read on the front page of newspapers, or at least on the science page, some new transitional form that's been found. I'll just give you a couple of examples here of what happens. For years, for example, the coelacanth fish was held to be our ancestor. In fact, the ancestor of all land animals and birds. And it was said to have died out 65 million years ago. But then in 1938, some fishermen off the coast of Madagascar hauled to the surface a live coelacanth in their nets from deep on the ocean floor. And the headlines went around the world, living fossil found. Now, that's a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it, living fossil? But from their perspective, you can understand it. It was absent from what they considered to be the top 65 million years worth of sedimentary layers. Therefore, it had become extinct 65 million years ago, having first evolved into existence about 234 million years ago, if my memory serves me correctly. But guess what? We've got living coelacanths today, just the same as the ones in the fossil record. And one of the things Professor Groves said in his first talk, he was actually coming at it from the evolutionary presupposition that the sedimentary layers represent the order of evolution and extinction, and he said, you'll never find rhinoceroses or mammals in amongst dinosaur strata. Well, in fact, they have, but it's kept quiet as much as possible. There are only very few papers that sort of slip through the editorial net, the censorship, and of course we latch onto those, but a recent article in Creation Magazine, one of our guys went around the various museums and talked with the curators of museums, and we got some brilliant quotes in that article about how there are lots and lots and lots of mammals found alongside dinosaurs, but they don't attract the research grant funding, you see. So who's going to write about them? Now, as well as the censorship that exists against that sort of discovery becoming known, there's no incentive to do so. Look, this is another example of the sort of thing that happens. This is a bit old now, but front page news, Boxgrove Man, and it was heralded as a missing link in a relatively recent human ancestry, but the evidence they found was limited to a shin bone. But that didn't stop them creating a story that this critter was 180 centimetres tall, weighed 80 kilograms, ate elephant and rhinoceros. But how did you get that from a piece of shin bone? You know, and again, I'm going to quote from evolutionists ad infinitum here. Everybody knows fossils are fickle. Bones will sing any song you want to hear. See, even if we start from the evolutionary presupposition about the rock layers representing long periods of time, what do we find? We find these organisms here, the white areas here represent, as you go down through the layers, where these particular critters have been found. But the dotted lines represent the hoped-for transitional forms. Where are they? We can do more limited way with the dinosaurs more recently in evolutionary history. How many dinosaur fossils have they found? Now, this diagram was put together about 5 years ago, so there might be elements of it which are now out of date. But when we look at the fossil evidence, we find huge amounts of bird fossils, for example, but here you see the numbers for these other specific kinds of dinosaurs. But when it comes to the hoped-for transitional forms, where are they? Now, where I'm coming from is this. Can man, by himself, determine what happened in the past? No, we can't. I wouldn't have a clue what happened before I was born, if not for the fact that other people were around before. In fact, the only way I know my birth date is because I got a birth certificate signed by two witnesses. When it comes to the sort of science that gives us a sense that of advancement and useful things are produced by it. It's all what I call eyewitness science, or experimental science. And that's the sort of science I did as an agricultural scientist. That doesn't mean there was a cost in terms of loss compared with if I were now re-embarking on my agricultural science career with a young creationist perspective, I would have done some things very differently, and I think I would have had better success in certain areas because of a perspective that God has created the plants, He's created the seasons, He's created the plants, He's picked the seasons, that when you're trying to produce out-of-season mangoes, sort of get the picture? I didn't have that perspective. I was a Christian, but at that stage I was still an old earth Christian. God used evolution somehow over millions of years. But the science that Professor Groves is a part of, unfortunately, paleontology and also anthropology, to some extent archaeology, comes under what we would call forensic science. You might want to be generous and call it historical science, but it's actually not history. It's looking at evidence in the present, so that part of it is eyewitness science, looking at the fossils in the present that you can hold, but the fossils do not speak. The fossils do not tell us anything. They have to be interpreted. And so Professor Groves has shown you interpretations of the fossils from the underlying naturalistic paradigm that is evolution, that there's no God, that everything just came into being by itself over millions and billions of years. So next time you read a press release from a university, a group of researchers or whatever, can you please separate out the eyewitness stuff from the speculation about what happened before the researchers were even born? I think one of the problems with modern science, aside from the fact it's been thoroughly redefined from what it should be, is the researchers have strayed from this key instruction from their manufacturer. You know, I like to joke, if you repair a car, it's wise to follow the manufacturer's instructions. Here are some instructions from our manufacturer for the maintenance and servicing of our thinking. We have to let every matter be established on the testimony of two or more witnesses. As I say, that is eyewitness science. You can't use eyewitness science today to determine whether... You can't use the modern scientific method, I should say, which rules out history, to determine whether the Second World War was a real event and the date it started and the date it finished. You need eyewitness accounts. And similarly with the past, especially the beginning of time, the beginning of matter, the beginning of energy, you need a history book from someone who was there. And so, for those of you who are Christians, but thinking, well, I can accept millions of years, I used to be in your shoes, but not anymore. And I want to share with you what turned me around. I actually went along to a young earth creationist seminar as an old age Christian. And I went along to tell these guys where they were wrong. But I was the one who realised I was wrong. Now this wouldn't have happened for an atheist, I don't think. I already had to be Christian in order to start from the premise that my God does not lie, and His word can be trusted. And so this is a key verse. God looked at all He had made at the end of day six and saw it was very good. And then the speakers put up a picture, the top of which looked like this. Here we've got a representation of Eden, here's Adam and Eve and so on. And of course, bear in mind, God looked at all He had made at the end of day six, including Satan, everything. And my fallen angels at that point, everything was still very good. But then the speaker put up a representation of my Eden. My Eden was an Eden built on top of the fossil record, because I accepted evolution over millions of years, and man's the result of the millions of years. And that means that I was putting death before Adam sinned. You see, to get a fossil, something has to die. I was putting death before sin and suffering. You see one animal eating another, terrible bloodshed, you see cannibalism in dinosaurs, terrible diseases like cancer and osteoarthritis in the fossil record. And so what confronted me with this picture was, would my God of love have used these tools of death, bloodshed, disease and suffering to bring a very good world into existence? Makes no sense. And the fundamental doctrinal issue here is this: if we put the shedding of blood before Adam sinned, why did God shed blood? Because of sin. Why did Jesus die on the cross? You see where we're heading with this. No wonder when I was a long-age Christian, you know, my pastor would say, get out there and witness to the lost. And I'd very sheepishly go out and say, oh, you need Jesus in your life. And they say, this Jesus, is that The same codger that his heavenly father allowed to be hung and to dry and die on a cross. Why did that have to happen? I had no answer. But now I understand there was no other way by which man could be saved, because we've all inherited Adam's sinful nature, and yet, you know, without shedding blood, there's no forgiveness of sins, no animal sacrifice will suffice. It has to be a human sacrifice, someone at the center of the first man Adam, and yet he was without sin. There's only one that can be, by definition, the Creator himself, the Lamb of God, slain for the sins of the world. And so this picture was what turned me around. This is what stopped me from being an old earth Christian, and when I started my present paradigm of thinking, which I think is the one I'll carry with me to my death, which is that the Bible is true, the genealogies add up to 6,000 years, and so that's the way it is, because God doesn't lie. So how then do I now understand the fossils? Well, if everything was very good before Adam's sin, none of these fossils can predate Adam's sin. So is there some event in the Bible that might explain why we find lots of these fossils? And there is. Three whole chapters are devoted to it in Genesis. You know, if something's important, do you think God would devote three chapters to it? Well, he has. The global flood of Noah's day. And you've probably heard of the 40 days and 40 nights of rain, but what gets primarily mentioned here, the famine of the great deep breaking up. Now today, and this is an extract from my first year geology book at university, you can get disturbances on the seabed which can trigger very fast currents, and look how fast they can flow. In fact, in this case here, 40-55 kilometres per hour, they've actually been clocked at more than double that. That's faster than any fish can swim. Anything in the way just gets covered over, smothered and buried. And if it's buried deeply enough, then scavengers won't be able to get to it. And so we've got a model here for understanding the fossils, for understanding the world around us. See, as a Queenslander, I can tell you that I've never seen a local flood in Queensland that had nice, clean water flowing. When floods happen in Queensland, they happen big time, but there's still only local floods. But they pick up sand and silt and sediment, even cars and houses, carry them downstream. Now, if this sort of thing gives us an insight into what the three chapters in the Bible about the global flood are all about, then we can make a prediction. Notice I've actually started from God's word, because I wasn't around in the past. He says he was. It started from his word. I can predict that we would therefore expect to find billions of dead things buried in layers that are now hardened into rock. We should find evidence they've been laid down by fast-flying water all over the earth. And guess what we find? Billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down the water all over the earth. And many of these are beautifully preserved. This fossil fish looks almost good enough to scale and eat. It doesn't fit with the paradigm that's in high school, or was in high school geology textbooks, shows a fish living and dying, sinking to the bottom, slowly being covered over, late generations of fish live and die and so on. No, it doesn't work that way. And I remember now that when I went spearfishing with my dad, we never saw dead fish lying on the bottom waiting to be covered over and fossilised. Dead fish floats, as aquarium keepers of fish know full well. So, you know, there's a problem with the paradigm that's being taught about the fossilisation process. Here's a salamander, not only so beautifully preserved as you can see the folds in its tail, but also its beautiful three-dimensional gill structure. This next one is one of my favourite fossils. Got covered over so quickly, didn't even have a chance to finish swallowing its lunch. You know, if you take film footage of a fish swallowing another fish, it happens so quickly that in order to see that particular moment, you've got to slow it down frame by frame. Now, some people say to me, well, that must have just been a one-off, a fluke. No, there are other examples, and in this book we've got the sale up there. It's an expensive coffee table book, so those of you students probably won't be able to afford it. But here's a photograph on page 105 of another fossil showing the same position, a fish in the mouth of a bigger fish. By the way, Christians who say to me, listen, I'm with you against evolution, but the act of being on about you know, age of the universe and so on, that's strategically done. No, I think it's strategically smart, as does the author of this book. We didn't produce this book, but we're happy to on-sell it. Look at the confrontational title. Maybe I'll put it on the screen so everyone can see it. The Young Earth. the unearthed. And could I encourage you, Christians, if you want to provoke your visitors to conversation, this would be a great way of doing it. Slip it on the coffee table. I guarantee you when you're making a cuppa, but what is this? I've got a friend who believes the earth's only 6,000 years old. If you're looking for a cheapie, students, here, here's one, $3.50, and it's got that picture in of a fish swallowing a fish, and this one here. This is a female ichthyosaur. How do I know it's a female? Well, here's a junior coming out of the birth canal at the exact moment of preservation. If we've got any mothers here, ladies, I've heard of long labours, but I cannot imagine this was happening over long periods of time, waiting to be fossilised. That particular moment happens quickly. By the way, if you've got cards, we've got FPOS. But look at this. The horseshoe crab is another example of a so-called living fossil, exactly the same as its counterpart in the fossil record, supposedly millions of years older. And look, even its tracks have been preserved trailing after it. Now, I can't prove from the evidence that the Earth's only 6,000 years old. But nor can the Long Ages prove from the evidence that the Earth is 4.6 billion, I think it currently is. 4.63.
4.567.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weinweber. We've been having a great yarn, by the way, and I'm sure it'll continue tomorrow in the breaks. So when we look at the evidence, we look at it differently. In fact, I have to say, it spoiled it for me, the romance of it all. See, I used to believe in billions of years, and I thought, oh, yeah, Grand Canyon, it's like bushwalking in Flinders Ranges. Look at these steep canyons. I thought, wow, this little creek trickling down here must have taken a long period of time. Well, I don't have that perspective anymore. My perspective is now much more realistic. And I now discover that the Colorado River is actually one of many watercourses around the world that geologists describe as being underfit rivers. Why? Because the present volume flowing down those canyons and gorges can't explain these steep-sided cliffs tens of kilometres apart at the top, in the case of the Grand Canyon. I got a great explanation for it. In Psalms it talks about the end of the flood. The mountain ranges were pushed up, the ocean basin sank down, the waters poured off the continents to the place God had assigned them, the place they may not cross, because God promised he would never again destroy the earth in the global flood. When I did first year geology, wasn't my favourite subject, but when I did it, I remember asking my geology lecturer, and I was an atheist, okay, so I had no agenda, all right, but I asked him, look, you know these pictures of folded mountain ranges that you've shown, how come they didn't fold? Why didn't they mend? And he said, I don't really know either. They must have just become like plastic over very long time periods. See, beware of deep time. Right. As soon as you hear that phrase, deep time, you know there's a bit of sleight of hand happening. It's magic, okay? It all happens over deep time. Alright, whereas I look at it now and I say, these rocks weren't folded over deep time. This happened quickly while they were still wet and supple like a clay pot before it's put into the oven. You know, I'm probably getting into trouble for pinging poor old Charles Darwin here, but in his Origin of Species, he made this prediction. He said, we'll never find jellyfish fossils. His exact words were, no organism, polysoft, can be preserved. Well, let's have a reality check here. We find hundreds of jellyfish fossils. And this isn't young earth creationists finding them, secular creationists. This is Dr. James Hagedorn, and his photograph of some of the fossils that he wrote up about that were discovered at a Wisconsin quarry. And, you know, it just looks to us like the sort of scene you'd see down the beach today. Ripple marks in the sand, and these fossilised jellyfish there. And how can this be? Well, they've got a scenario that over 100,000 years there were a series of storms. Well, here's my scenario. The same evidence, different interpretation. I say that this was a swarm of jellyfish that was overcome during the flood by all the sediment in the water. And in fact, in the description in Hagedorn's paper, he talks about how the bells looked like they were filled with fluid with a heavy silt load. So who's got the best interpretation here? Look at this plesiosaur embedded in sandstone. Alright? Doesn't it fit with what you'd expect? I mean, it's hard to see a local flood, it is jaw-dropping. to see a global fight. Imagine the forces at work. Yeah, I think we've got a great explanation for the possibility. And so, this is not the order of evolution and extinction over millions and millions of years. This is the order of burial in a global flood and its aftermath. In which case, there was no age of dinosaurs. Whoa, that's a bit hard, isn't it? Well, let's take this through. If there's no age of dinosaurs, but the Bible gives the accurate account of history, two of every kind of land animal and bird were brought to Noah to take on board the ark. That would have included all the different kinds of dinosaurs. So we ought to find some evidence, seeing they all came off the flood, off the ark at the end of the flood, of them spreading out again. And indeed we do. Not as the word dinosaur, that's a modern word coined in the 1800s, but we do find accounts of things like dragons. Here's one from Ireland, about 1100 years ago. Some kind of creature that had iron nails on its tail with pointed backwards. When I give this talk at primary schools or something like it, the kids are very quick to say, wow, that sounds like a stegosaur. Yeah, it sure does. Here's another example. A cathedral in the UK, 1,000 years old, and the bishops who've served there over the years have been buried in tombs in the cathedral. Here's the tomb of Bishop Bell, so at least 600 years old. And on the brass inlay are engraved critters that we would recognise today, like fish and eels and dogs and birds, and what any school child educated in dinosaurs today would immediately identify as something like sauropod dinosaurs. You know, so lots of examples. I mean, the Chinese calendar. Have you ever wondered why they've got 11 real animals and one fictitious animal? I put to you, it wasn't fictitious. It was alive at the time. It hadn't yet become extinct. You know, when you look at the evidence, it's all around the world, but it depends on your paradigm. Dr. Mary Schweitzer is no young Earth creationist. All right? But she, over the last 18 years, has been involved in a series of discoveries of soft tissue in dinosaur bones. Yes, bones, not completely permineralized, but bones. And look at her surprise, as recorded in the Life in Science journal. It was exactly like looking at a slice of modern bone. But of course I couldn't believe it. I said to the lab technician, the bones, after all, are 65 million years old. How could blood cells survive that long? Wrong question. The question to ask is, what's wrong with our paradigm that says these things have been around for, they died out 65 million years ago? That's the problem. You know, again, she went out by helicopter 10 years after her first discovery, and they loaded up the helicopter with lots of specimens. And as the sun was setting, the cry went up, someone had found a magnificent T-Rex specimen. So they had to make room in the helicopter to shove it in, but one bone wouldn't fit in unless they broke it. But I reckon that was God's providence, because when they broke it, guess what came out? Soft, squishy stuff. And as Dr. Mary Schweitzer says, this is not something I ever dreamed I'd see. This is not something I ever dreamed I'd see. Could I encourage you, keep up to date with the news that's not reported in the mainstream media, but via places like our website, creation.com. And here's the article I wrote recently on discovery of hadrosaur skin. Now, a bit limited here because they haven't yet published a scientific paper, so all I could do was quote what he said to the journalists. But yes, it's basically skin. And this is what he said, this is real skin. We became incredibly excited because he had expected to just find skin impressions, real skin. But here's the question they want to ask and find out the answer. How the fossil remain intact for around 70 million years? Again, I say, wrong question. Now, I encourage you to read our website every day. We've got a fresh article up there each day. But if you get busy, we run an email news service called InfoBytes. And out there on the book tables, we've got, it's completely free, by the way, to sign up for InfoBytes. We've got a sign-up form. So even if you're an atheist here tonight, and by the way, good on you for coming, and I thank the atheist speakers who have come along, because in one sense you've come into a bit of the lion's den here. You know, Christians, I made a prediction that Charlie would be mobbed at the end of each session by earnest Christians backing him up against the wall, and that's indeed what happened at lunchtime today. But he said he doesn't mind. It's his first real time to mix with rabid Christians, is that right? I can quite remember.
Yeah, sure.
Full-blown Christians.
That's right. Now, Professor Groves criticised me in advance for talking about pictures like this and for quoting evolutionists, but I mean, that's, you're not going to listen to me, are you? So I have to quote from Hostile Witnesses. This is evolutionary paleoanthropologist Bernard Wood, and he said this about the classic icon that you find on Woolworths supermarket shelves trying to flog your meat, because you've got to go back to our hunter-gatherer origins. And he says, you find it everywhere, left is an ape, right a man, between the two is a succession of figures that become ever more like humans. Our progress from ape to human looks so smooth, so tidy. It's such a beguiling image that even the experts are loath to let it go, but it's an illusion. It's an illusion. So remember that next time you see it, okay? That's from the mouth of the experts. It's an illusion. And the sharp-eyed ones, I mean, who will note that quote's now over 10 years old, I can't remember the exact date. But here's a more recent quote from him in just 2011. The origin of our own genus remains frustratingly unclear. By the way, in our literature, we're always careful to cite the secular paper references, so that if you Christians are witnessing to atheists and they refuse to have a bar of creation.com or our magazine or journal, just jot down the secular references and have them go back to the original jellyfish paper by James Hagedorn, for example, and put to them the challenge. How does that fit? Do you really think it was a series of storms over 100,000 years? Look, there's lots more I could share with you here, but my time is running out. 8:30 is the limit, isn't it, Mr. Moderator? Yep, okay. So let me just jump through and see what else I can talk about. Oh, yeah, well, look, while we're on Professor Wood, I'm very happy to quote him again here. Tell me about that. He says, we know from living animals that many uncontested species are difficult to distinguish using bones and teeth. And he gives some examples there. In other words, you can take a skeleton from an animal that has been alive today, give it to an anatomist, and say, look, can you reconstruct this to tell us what it was? And they'll be shy of the mark. So what hope do you have with the, the ones that supposedly died out millions of years ago. It's all speculation. We're told to seek eyewitnesses. And when it comes to dating, a part of radiometric dating is eyewitness science. It's the part where they analyse the sample for the amount of, say, potassium or argon, in the case of potassium-argon dating. But those measurements are made in the present. How you go back to the past will depend on your assumptions. And to use a layman's version here, let's say I invited you into my lab and we've got a measuring cylinder there with a tap slowly dripping in it. And I asked you, could you please first measure the rate at which it's dripping, and you can do that, it's 50 millilitres per hour, and you can see there's 300 mils in the measuring cylinder. So how long has that tap been dripping into that cylinder? And most people at this point do the mental calculation and they come up with what you get. If you were assuming that the rate is always being the same in the past as it is today. But I'll give you an eyewitness account of how that cylinder got to that point. I filled it to 250 mils an hour ago and I let it sit there for an hour and the remaining 50 mils has dripped in. See, the only way you could know that though is with an eyewitness account. And so how do we test radiometric dating? Well, let's go to rocks where we know the age and apply the technique. And so Mount St. Helens, a series of eruptions in the 1980s, and so the lava, because this form of dating works only on volcanic rock. When it works, does it work? Let's have a look. The analysis came back, because we didn't tell them that we knew the age, 350,000 years. Actually, secular scientists have done this as well. And when they came up with the 350,000 years, well, that's not right. It should only be 35 years. So they used their assumptions and said, we can whittle it down to just part of the rock because the rest might have been contamination as the lava came up. So let's only analyse the amphibole and such like. Well, it came even worse. 900,000 years for rock that only ought to be showing a reading of about 30 years. So they did it again, this time narrowing it down to pyrites, and even worse again, 2.8 billion years. Lots more examples I could show of this, but the punchline, as we put in Creation Magazine, radiometric dating is in rubble. Now, as I've chosen one site here that might be relevant to Professor Gross Field. I'm sure he's very familiar with the K. Berensmeyer site, or KBS TUF as it's known. This is in southern Africa. And basically, they could date the TUF because of the presence of volcanic material in it. But there's a problem because the layer immediately above the TUF, virtually inseparable from it, contains fossils of things like elephants, pigs, apes, and tools. Because tools imply human activity, don't they? And so the initial potassium argon dating of the TUF that came out over 200 million years, well, that's a problem, that's absurd. Therefore, guess what they did? They rejected the date. Why did they reject the date? Because it didn't fit their own paradigm. So they said, look, we need to focus in only analysing the feldspar and the pumice, and that's a lot better. 2.61 million years. Sure, what a relief. Problem solved. Until, by the way, other researchers came in and used different techniques and so on, and they confirmed that date with paleomagnetism and fission tracks. But then a problem. And those of you who read Time magazine might remember the big headlines. Richard Leakey found this skull, which has become known as KNMER 1470. And he was very excited because, wow, we've never found such an old skull of this form, this age, 2.61 million years. He was over the moon. But his evolutionary colleagues were less so. No, that can't be right. We must have made a mistake with the dating. So now they go back to the dating because it doesn't suit them anymore, and they reject all those dates and narrow it down again, and by whatever selection processes they did, 1.82 million years, that's tolerable. And guess what? Other researchers came in and confirmed it with paleomagnetism and fission tracks. Can you see what's happening there? See, when the radiometric dates don't suit the long ages, they'll reject them. And then they criticise us for doing the same thing. You know, I haven't got time to go into all of this. My presentation tomorrow, though, will focus more on the biological aspects and also the age aspects. For those of you who can't come tomorrow, or for everyone anyway, please, if you'd like to read probably the most controversial article on our website, the atheists certainly know it's there. The Google rating has gone skyrocketing. It's called 101 Evidences for a Young Age of the Earth and Universe. Very easy to remember. Where do I begin this whole topic? I could talk for millions and millions of years. But, you know, don't let them make a monkey out of you. See, ideas have consequences. And maybe tomorrow I can share more about how the time factor really is an issue. This is something that was donated by the Australian Skeptics to various Australian schools, so they have an agenda here. His skeptics paying money to get these little booklets into various schools. Making friends with fossils, how to find your way through a maze of human origins. And guess who wrote the foreword? None other than Dr. Groves. It's important for us to know where we came from and how we got here, and that we are not so special. In other words, we're not created in the image of God. We're just another animal. So, those of you who profess Christ here, please, could you think about these issues? And, you know, some ordinary Christians, I know that Professor Groves, you know, sounds very knowledgeable, and it's very intimidating, okay? But the Word of God, the testimony of the Lord, makes wise and simple. I'm only an agricultural scientist, right? I find it very intimidating being up against the likes of high-flying mathematicians and physicists, because I never did well at physics and maths. But anybody can do this. And here's what just a simple Christian lady did. She wrote in to the Canberra Times that had published some of Professor Groves' material, And she said, if Professor Groves wishes to claim descent from a relationship to apes, that's his business, but include me up, thanks. I'm descended from Adam and Eve, God's highest and most unique creation. The other orders, greater orders, are our stewardship, not our relations. Yeah, I don't claim to have some ape-like critter in my ancestry. I'm just a bit non-sexist, but I did the grandmother thing as well. You know, reality says when you go to the zoo, that we do have stewardship over the other creatures. There is a gulf between humans and modern-day apes. A huge, huge gulf. And it's right in line with what Genesis said. God gave these creatures to us to look after them, to have good stewardship over them. Not to destroy them, but to look after them. I don't know where to begin with all this stuff. I've got so much stuff. By the way, for skeptics, we've actually brought a book along for you. We trust you'll pay for it, though. It's called Christianity for Skeptics. And it starts a very logical place. Chapter 1, does God exist? First principles. Is atheism rational? Because they like to call themselves rational thinkers. Well, here's a challenge for those of you who like to call yourself rational thinkers, who don't believe in God. Try and read this book and find fault with it. Because basically you're on the road to nowhere. And a consistent atheist would recognise that. Here's something that one of my sons absolutely loves. Apparently some atheist died and some joker wrote on his tombstone, here lies an atheist all dressed up with nowhere to go. And if you're wondering why there's been such a huge increase in stupid thinking, I put to you it's because the idea that there's a universe of order created by a God of order is becoming so unfashionable that it's opened the way for a whole raft of New Age ideas that we're not really here and reality's not real and so on and so forth. If there's just one book that you want to buy tonight out of curiosity, interest, whatever, Creation Answers book helps you to always be ready to give an answer. The key questions that come up, where did Cain get his wife, or as modern day kids put it, who aren't familiar with the name Cain in the Bible, they say, how can we always all go back to Adam and Eve? What's the problem? How can we do that, given today, if sisters and brothers marry one another, you get all these mutations in the genes? I'll be talking more about that in tomorrow's session. I trust you've enjoyed this session. I need to acknowledge that I'm only one of a panel of speakers with Creation Ministries International. I'm only a simple agricultural scientist, but my colleagues who believe the Bible include nuclear physicists and a raft of other scientists of different disciplines, because the scriptures say there's wisdom in a multiplicity of counsellors and there are many parts of the body. And so our job is to relay the true science to you in a way that the layman can take and run and talk with the man on the street in such a way that you can demolish these arguments that come from the enemy and show people that they can indeed love the Lord God with all their heart, soul, mind and strength. So I'll finish there because my time is up. Thank you very much.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.